instead turned it into a department that the president can use to further his own wrongdoing.
David, I wanted to ask you, this is not the first attorney general that Trump has fired. Talk about his record with previous attorney generals, Jeff Sessions, Bill Barr during his first term, and why he keeps getting rid of people whose advice he doesn't like.
Well, you know, that's the thing. I mean, he's fired previous attorney generals because they have dared to stand up to him. They have dared to say no. And these are not, you know, knee-jerk liberals. Jeff Sessions, very, very conservative man. Bill Barr, very, very conservative man. But they said no at various times to him, which is the job of the Attorney General of the United States. And for that, they lost their jobs. The remarkable thing about Pam Bondi is, as far as we can tell, she never said no. She never said no. And notwithstanding never saying no, she lost her job. Not because she dared to stand up to him, but because she didn't deliver on what are really undeliverable promises. You know, the you're not going to be able to prosecute James Comey or Letitia James or Jerome Powell. Those cases are going nowhere. And the fact that President Trump doesn't like them because they did their job is not a crime. And will not support a criminal prosecution. So she was asked to do the impossible by the president. She failed to do the impossible. And so he has fired her, and he'll bring in somebody else and ask them to do the impossible. And either they will say no, and he'll fire them, or they will fail because it's impossible, and he will fire them. But he has basically asked the Justice Department to do things it cannot do.
As we wrap up, I mean, perhaps the most significant image of Pam Bondi's term as attorney general is her unfurling of that banner of President Trump over the Department of Justice. But I wanted to ask you a quick question about a critical piece you just wrote, headlined The Lie of Preventive War, where you write, never has Donald Trump's willful blindness to legal limits been more evident than in his decision to start a war with Iran. Explain.
Well, the basic, and this too, I mean, when you look at our military actions, those actions require Justice Department to approve them as lawful. There is no way you can justify as lawful what we are doing in Iran, what we did in Venezuela, what we did to the over 100 people that we have summarily executed on the high seas. And the Justice Department has either looked the other way or written memos saying that that's lawful. But with respect to Iran, Iran posed no imminent threat to the United States. The UN Charter absolutely prohibits one country from aggressively attacking another country, using force against another country, unless that country has attacked us, and Iran had not attacked us, or the UN has authorized that intervention. The UN did not authorize that intervention. It was a blatantly illegal on that ground. It was also blatantly illegal under the Constitution, because the Constitution says that the Congress, not the president, has the authority to authorize military actions. And yet the president took these actions. You know, he famously told the New York Times, you know, it's just his own sense of morality that limits him, nothing else. And as we've seen, that's not a meaningful limit.
Well, David Cole, we want to thank you so much for being with us, professor in law and public policy at the Georgetown University Law Center, former ACLU National Legal Director. We'll link to your article, The Lie of Preventive War. This is Democracy Now! Coming up next, President Trump's trying again to unilaterally change voting laws ahead of the midterms, this time targeting mail-in voting. even though that's just what he did in Florida in the last weeks. We'll be joined by the Arizona Secretary of State, Adrian Fontes. Stay with us.
In 1649, to St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to sing and sow. We come to work the land in common and to make the waste ground grow. This earth divided, we will make whole. So it shall be a common treasury for all. The sin of property we do disdain. No man has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. By theft and murder, they took the land. Now everywhere the walls rise up at their command.
The World Turned Upside Down by Billy Bragg. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Democrats and voting advocacy groups have filed three separate lawsuits against President Trump's sweeping new executive order to limit mail-in and absentee voting ahead of this year's midterm elections. Trump's order directs the Department of Homeland Security to create a state citizenship list. It also directs the U.S. Postal Service to mail ballots only to verified, quote-unquote, voters. Voting rights experts have decried the executive order as an unconstitutional attempt by Trump to seize control of election administration from the states and Congress. Plaintiffs in one of the lawsuits said, quote, attempts to end voting by mail are part of the Trump administration's larger strategy to undermine elections and subvert the will of the people, unquote. Trump's attack on mail-in voting comes just days after he defended his decision to recently vote by mail in Florida.
You know what? Because I'm president of the United States, and because of the fact that I'm president of the United States, I did a mail-in ballot for elections that took place in Florida because I felt I should be here instead of being in the beautiful sunshine taking—
You were in Palm Beach, sir, the last few weekends.
That's right. And I decided that I was going to vote by mail-in ballot because I couldn't be there because I had a lot of different things.
We're joined now by Arizona's Democratic Secretary of State, Adrian Fontes, who's blasted Trump's executive order as, quote, disgusting overreach from the federal government, unquote. Arizona is among several states the Trump administration sued in order to access sensitive voter data. The state was also at the center of Trump's false claims of election fraud in 2020. Secretary of State Adrian Fontes, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why do you describe the president's actions as disgusting, and explain Arizona's mail-in vote system?
Well, thank you for having me first. And I call it disgusting because it is. First and foremost, Article 1, Section 4 reserves the power to establish the time, place, and manner of elections to the states alone and gives Congress a role. Now, the president has previously issued an executive order that he got shot down on. The rule of law now in the country is he doesn't have a role in administering our elections, and yet he tried again. This is a lawless president, and that's why this is a disgusting overreach. He's already been told by the courts this is not his business, and yet he's trying to do it again. One of the other reasons that I called it that is because this is clearly an attempt for the president to pick his own voters. He doesn't really care about the real voice of American voters, which would mean that he would expand the franchise. He would ask more and more ways to find more voters to be voting, qualified as they are, but to make sure that everybody had access, to make sure that all voters had convenient ways of casting their ballots so that the governed could give their consent to the government. That's the rule that we have been established by. So, but for both of those reasons, I think it's disgusting. Now, mail-in voting in Arizona is is what's kind of classified as a no-excuse absentee system. You don't need an excuse to vote by mail. It was created by Republicans in the early 1990s. It has been promoted by them and kept them in power here in Arizona for quite some time. And it's convenient. And what's also very important, let me give you an example. My own 80-something-year-old mom does not need to stand in line and be kind of pressured to fill out a two-page long ballot in some elections with up to 85 different elections on that two-page ballot, which we have seen in Maricopa County, Arizona. She doesn't have to feel rushed. She can do it at the convenience of her home, at her kitchen table, on her couch, look up the propositions, you know, do research on the judges. Our no-excuse absentee system, our mail-in voting system in Arizona is robust, it is secure, and not only in 2016, but in 2024, it elected Donald Trump as president. So what we have here is, I think, some confusion on the part of the president about what's effective, what's secure, and really, I think the maliciousness behind this has been shown bare on its face. He's trying to pick his own voters.
And Secretary of State Fontes, you mentioned that the mail-in voting system in Arizona dates back to the 1990s. Had there ever been complaints previously about the system before the Trump era?
Well, the one complaint we had about the system was that it used to be where the registrar of voter, the county recorders, would mail a postcard to every voter every single election, and the voters would say, yes, I want a ballot by mail, and send it back. Then they would send the ballot. So that ended up getting stopped, and we had what was called a permanent early vote list. So you would sign on to it, and that increased the vote by mail numbers year in and year out without exception, until these election conspiracy theories and lies about vote by mail started. The list is no longer permanent because of the prior governor and legislature made it so that it is now called an active early vote list, and it's easier to get dropped off that list, although you're still registered and you can still vote. So the complaints have only really started when Donald Trump was the president, and he spread his lies either before an election, just in case he lost, he'd have an excuse, or after an election because he felt like he should have won unanimously or some nonsense like that. I'm not even sure about how that works.
Now, earlier this year, you introduced statewide legislation, the Voters First Act. What does that do, and how are you trying to safeguard the integrity of the 2026 midterms in Arizona?
Well, the Voters First Act had 10 different components in it, and unfortunately, under the Republican leadership in the legislature, it no longer, I think, is going to see the light of day. But it really made a whole bunch of different spaces in our elections much more secure. It gave us funding for the ERIC system. It made vote centers a part of the law, which means any voter in any county can vote anywhere in their county, no longer allowing for precinct-based voting only, which has shown to increase provisional ballots, which isn't always great. And it did a variety of other things that helped access, it helped convenience, it helped voters, and it put a good chunk of money into the election budgets for our counties, which, because Arizona is a bottom-up state, the counties really do a lot of the work. I'm more of like a commissioner in a major sports league. We establish the rules, we certify the officials, we certify the equipment. It's the counties that do a lot of the work. So we were trying to bolster what they could do and really make it better for the voters, because that's really kind of where the rubber meets the road.
Adrian Fontes, the latest news, Pam Bondi fired by President Trump. And I was wondering if you could comment on her tenure and how it affects your work as Secretary of State for Arizona. As Juan pointed out in our earlier segment, the DOJ sending letters to nearly 40 states demanding sensitive information, including driver's license, social security numbers from every registered voter. If you can talk about your resistance and where you go from here.
Well, my resistance started back in June of 2025 when I was asked to turn over a bunch of sensitive voter data, sort of some of which you mentioned, but also including mother's maiden name, date and day and month of birth, tribal ID numbers, things that were not allowed by law to turn over. So they asked us to violate state and federal law They asked us to violate the Privacy Act of 1974. I said no, repeatedly. And then they sued the state of Arizona and my administration. We will continue to fight this fight in court, whether or not Pam Bondi is the attorney general. And as an aside, good riddance. She was terrible anyway. So we'll see what happens with the next one. Hopefully better than the last, but I'm reluctantly hopeful. But what's going to happen in the future is I'm going to keep standing up for the voters in Arizona, whether they are Democrats, Republicans, independents, or whatever. This is about the American voice. And I said it earlier, when we expand the franchise, we get a better idea of what Americans actually want. By narrowing and constricting through a lot of these different tactics that we see being used, what we're doing is getting a narrower view. And a decision maker has to have more information. Folks that are in leadership must understand what's really going on out there. So leaders who try to constrict voting rights, who try to shrink the voice of the American people, they're actually shortchanging themselves and they're going to be less effective. That's one of the reasons why once we're done with this first term, I hope I can get another one come November. But we're going to keep up this fight. As long as I am the Secretary of State, we're going to fight, number one, to protect our voters and their rights. Number two, their data, which comes directly along with that. And number three, continue to open access to all eligible Arizonans and Americans so that we can have that real voice represented in our government.
Adrian Fontes, I want to thank you for being with us, Secretary of State of Arizona, elected in 2022. Previously, the Maricopa County recorder who oversaw the 2020 elections. He's legally challenging Trump's new voting order. And we will do an interview with you in Spanish after the broadcast and post it at democracynow.org. When we come back, Palestinian activist Laka Cordia is out of ICE jail after a year. She joins us in studio. Stay with us. To You, composed by Ahmed Kabur, performed right here in New York by the New York City Palestinian Youth Choir. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show with Palestinian activist Laka Cordia. She was recently freed after spending a year in an ICE jail in Texas, arrested in March of last year as part of the Trump administration's campaign targeting activists and others who advocated for Palestinian rights. Laka Cordia grew up in the occupied West Bank, now lives in New Jersey. She says Israeli forces have killed more than two hundred members of her extended family in Gaza. In April 2024, Laka was arrested during a Gaza solidarity protest at Columbia University. The charges were dropped the following day. But in March of last year, Laka was detained after meeting with immigration officials in New Jersey voluntarily. Her arrest came less than a week after federal immigration agents arrested the Columbia student protester organizer Mahmoud Khalil. He was jailed for 104 days. Laka Cordia is believed to have been the last person held in detention from the Trump administration's crackdown on pro-Palestinian campus activists. While in custody, she was hospitalized in February following her first seizure. In mid-March, she was freed after a judge ordered her release on a $100,000 bond. Laka Cordia joins us now in our studio. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's quite something to see you across the table. We've reported on you for so long. Laka, how are you feeling? How are you doing right now? A year in an ICE jail. We'd like you to describe your experience and how you were first taken.
First of all, thank you very much for having me. It's such an honor to be sitting with you today. How am I feeling now? I'm feeling blessed, grateful, but at the same time, the way that I feel, it's bittersweet, knowing that I left behind many courageous, innocent women and men who deserve nothing but freedom. They've done nothing wrong but dreaming. The last year was tough. It was long. It was... I've seen and experienced a lot of injustice. It's something was very disappointing to be there in the first place. I shouldn't be there in the first place.
You met with ICE or immigration agents in New Jersey. It was soon after Mahmoud Khalil was taken, so we knew that this was taking place, that people were being picked up. And describe what happened then. That was in New Jersey, in a detention center?
It was in a detention center in Newark, yes. Yes. It was supposed to be like just a meeting, regular meeting with my lawyer, along with my lawyer with the ICE agents. It led to arrest. They took me in an unmarked car directly to the airport, and they have informed my lawyer that I'm going to upstate New York, but they took me to Texas instead.
And what did they tell you in those early days about why they were holding you?
They were saying just it's something, it's an issue with my application. So I have a petition from my U.S. citizen mother to get that green card, and I have an approved I-130. So they just told me that you have an issue with your application. So basically they were lying to me.
And while you were in custody, you were hospitalized following a seizure. Your legal team said your legs were chained to your bed, and you were denied access to the lawyer, to your lawyer or family during that time. Could you talk about that?
Yes. So a few days before I experienced that seizure, actually, I was very sick. I've never had a fever like this in my whole life. I was extremely sick, and no one cared about me, the medical care didn't come to see me. I wasn't provided any medicine or anything. So a few days later, I fell down and I experienced my first ever seizure in my whole life. I was rushed to the hospital. The entire time I was chained to a hospital bed. We're talking about chains, not handcuffs. I was begging them to just at least free my hand. Just like, I feel weak, it's heavy. I was told that they can't. And when I asked to speak to the lieutenant said, no, we can't move it. And I asked why, and she said, because I said so. The experience was horrible. I felt like I'm an animal. I'm not a human being. I'm not being treated like a human being, being chained to a hospital bed. If I want to use the bathroom or a shower or anything, I'll be chained. I asked to speak to my mother. I was denied access to my mother. I asked to speak with my lawyers. I was denied access to my lawyers. I told them, fine, can you please inform my lawyers or my family? They refused. So basically, I felt like I'm being kidnapped.
You were detained at the Prairie Land Detention Center in Alvarado, Texas. Can you describe what the conditions were like inside and tell us some of the stories of the women that you were imprisoned with?
So I always say to speak about the conditions, we need days to speak about few of the conditions. First of all, it's a jail system. So the word detention, it's actually very nice to describe the place. It's dungeons, jail. For example, we were in a room that the capacity is supposed to be 37, but we were 66, sometimes 100. I slept on the floor for 3 months myself. There wasn't any bed, any available bunks for me. There were, we were most of the time overcrowded. We didn't really have access to the sunlight daily. The healthcare, it's horrible. They don't have doctors, they don't have nurses. Whoever is working in healthcare, they're like under the nurse. One time they gave me a shot, or actually they wanted to take a blood from me for like, blood test and all of that. And my hand actually swelled for almost like 2 weeks. And when I told them, like, can you please do something? They said, it is what it is. For example, the showers also got, they stopped working for almost 2 weeks. And when we kept complaining, like, the showers are not working, that's how people get sick, we were told it is what it is also. Every time we complain about something, we would be like, faced by like, shut up or stop complaining, or you should be thankful for all of this. The water has things swimming in it. We would sleep on a paper thin mattress. There were pregnant ladies, for example. Some ladies will have their pregnancy, like a risk pregnancy. Nobody will take care of them. Like, they weren't being seen by a doctor or anybody. The food there is horrible. We used to call it dog's food. And even like some of the detainees with me, they actually own dogs, and they would say, I don't even feed this food to my dog. So the like, if you ask for medical care or anything, most of the time it will be rejected. I had elderlies with me, 75 years old, 60 something years old, who've been in America for like 50 years or more, doing nothing, going to a regular check-in, following the law, doing the right thing.
These are civil offenses.
Yes, yes, absolutely. What I've seen there, it's actually daughters, mothers, doctors, teachers, workers, like, that's what I've seen there. I've seen girls 16 and 17 years old. I've seen a girl, she told me that they stormed her school, and they literally handcuffed her in front of her classmates. The humiliation. This actually, like, the detention center's conditions and the ICE agents' methods, like, brought to me, to my mind, to my memories, a lot of bad memories from the West Bank, and how Israeli soldiers would treat the Palestinian prisoners, or Palestinian in general, the humiliation, the way of like abusing, like mentally torturing. ICE dungeons are systematically built to break people mentally, to break people down, to make you give up, to make you beg to be deported, even though, like, you're gonna face a lot of injustice in your own country sometimes. But yes,
yeah. Yeah, I wanted to ask you. You mentioned your time in the West Bank. You've been living in the U.S. for nearly a decade after leaving the occupied West Bank, where you grew up with your father. You came to this country to reunite with your mother, who's a U.S. citizen. Talk about that. Your time, the comparisons you're raising, your time as a child in the West Bank.
And we just have 30 seconds.
I mean, I grew up under a military occupation. I grew up getting used to, if I want to go to school, I would go through a checkpoint, a military checkpoint. I was 9 years old, and I woke up on an Israeli soldier pointing his rifle on my face and laughing, literally laughing. I've seen my father being humiliated many times by the Israeli soldier. I experienced bombing, gas bombs. I've seen people dying in front of my eyes. Like, a father was shopping with his daughter, and he's just got killed for nothing.
I hate to cut you off. We have to end it there. No, thank you so much, Lakhat Khordia. For you to be here in studio means so much. Palestinian protester released from a Texas ICE jail after a year.
Thank you.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
Just one more thing before your interview. Can I have your address, please?
I live on Main Street.
I need your exact address.
I live on Main Street.
Oh.
No job, no home. And no home, no job. Don't let homelessness assumptions get in the way of homelessness solutions. Go to CanadaCanDoIt.ca. Help the Canadian Alliance to End Homelessness.